Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, sponsored by WebSpy. October 12, 2009, and this is episode 212. Today I'm joined by Jack Andriss, the CEO of our sponsors, WebSpy, the internet monitoring, analysis, and reporting specialists. We're going to mix it up a little bit as well because Jack is going to interview me. I've been asked many times to talk about myself on the show, but never quite got around to it. And then Jack came up with the idea of interviewing me, and I just thought that was a really good idea. So we're going to do that. Before we do get started, I'd like to thank Jack and WebSpy for their support and ask any of you listeners that use Twitter to tweet the message thanks to @WebSpy for sponsoring the @MartinBaileyPhotography podcast on Twitter to show your support. And to find out more about WebSpy and their products, go to webspy.com/MBP and use the discount code MBPWSY for a 10% discount on anything that you buy. And you can probably hear a little bit of noise coming over the Skype line as Jack is actually sitting there waiting patiently. So welcome to the show, Jack.
Thank you very much, Martin. How are you today in Japan?
I'm absolutely wonderful. I've actually got a little bit of a hangover. I had a pretty good weekend and we're on holiday today. So I went out last night and had one or two too many, I think.
All right. Well, yeah, I can understand that. I've certainly seen references to some of your tweets and mentions in podcasts about having one too many.
It doesn't happen that often, but it's once I go past a certain point, I get this big S appears on my chest, and it's like, you know, I can drink the world, and it's not actually the case. So
right.
So shall we jump into it? Actually, before we do that, I want to just say again, thank you very much, you know, personally for the sponsorship and everything. It's really, really helped to support the show and keep it all running. Thanks very much for all of that.
You're very welcome. I think, we certainly, when I say we, it's myself and the employees here, there's a high level of photographic interest. So I think we have about 5 of the employees around here that have been listening to you for a very long time.
That's great.
So they're very, very supportive. And certainly I've had a high level of interest in your show ever since you've commenced. I think I came in at about podcast 3 or 4 and I quickly caught up on the first few. Right. And so that's 211 podcasts before this one and 4 years.
Yeah.
And I can certainly remember times in my life over the last 4 years where I can relate to a specific Martin Bailey podcast. So that sort of sounds a bit lame, maybe, but
not lame. It's amazing. I do go back and think of things and related to what I was podcasting about at the time as well. But to hear that from a listener, you know, it's amazing for me. It's a huge compliment, actually. But I, you know, recently on Twitter, and I think it was on Twitter, some people have said you know, that they're just going back listening to episode 5 or 8 or whatever it was, where I just got my 5D, not the Mark II, but the 5D. It was 4 years ago.
And I saw that.
Yeah,
on Twitter.
So yeah. People were saying, "Oh yeah," and you thought it was great, and there was and you thought that a 2 gigabyte CF card was amazing, and it's like, it's like an audio diary in many ways, because I do it a lot of like travelogue, or, you know, like I talk about shoots and things through the podcast. It is a little bit like an audio diary of my photographic life. So, I mean, for me as well, it's just, there's a lot of memories attached to it.
Certainly. And it's same with what you're doing with the workshops, because I remember the first workshop and the big event that was for you.
Yeah.
And now you're planning for the third.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's all growing from the podcast. I mean, and that is part of the reason why I started it. And, you know, I guess we can get into this a little bit later. But, you know, all of this, No, there's a number of reasons why I did start the podcast, and one of them was to be able to hopefully do things like that. So,
yeah, well, maybe I could kick off with some of the questions that we've prepared, and certainly my staff and I had two pages of questions specifically for you, and I think we've cut that down a bit to try and make it as personal as we can. Okay. Because I guess today what we'd like to find out is the man behind the photography, which is yourself. And I'm going to start off with a long time ago, going back to childhood. Great. So, and I imagine that was based in the UK.
Yes.
So I guess the first question that I have about you is just to tell us a little bit about your childhood, where you grew up, what school memories you have, best friends, how did photography fit into your childhood? Maybe one of your most memorable childhood stories would be interesting too.
Okay. So I was born in a small town called Long Eaton between Nottingham and Derby, the cities of Nottingham and Derby in England. And one of my friends always used to call Long Eaton like a pimple on the M1. And basically, the M1 is the big, the highway that goes from London up to Scotland, literally straight up the middle of the country. And if you look on a map of England, actually, if you look on Google Earth and things like that, or Google Map, and then zoom in to where it says England on the map, that's usually the very middle of the country, and it's that basically the nearest town to that. Unless it's changed recently, I haven't checked recently, but the nearest town to where it says England is Long Eaton, the town that I was brought up in. So it really is smack in the middle of England. It's in an area called the Midlands because it's in the middle, and it's about the furthest place from the sea as well. You can get to the east and the west coast in about the same amount of time from there. But it's a small town. It's a little bit rough sometimes. We've got the Nottingham Forest and Derby County football clubs, because Long Eaton's like between the two, they used to get a lot of people coming into town and basically wanted to just cause fights, which we ended up being a gang of four ourselves, literally just four friends going out for drinks. But we often got the football supporters, they just came into town for a fight and ended up sort of seeing that we looked like a little bit of a gang, so they picked on us a few times. So it was a bit of rough. My late teens were a little bit rough, but I enjoyed it. I had a good childhood. You mentioned about the schooling. I went to infants and junior school. It's different to like the US. I'm not sure what sort of system you use in Australia, but you know, in US you go in, you go through grades. In England, you've got like infant school. What we call infant school is probably like elementary school, and that's from when you're four or five until you're eight, and then and then you jump into junior school from eight until 11, and then onto high school from 11 or 12 until you're 16, and then they kick you out into society. So I went to a place called Brooklands Infant School, and then Brooklands Junior School until the fourth year. And then I went, we moved house, over to the other side of town. So I went to the high school I went to was called Willsthorpe, Willsthorpe Comprehensive School.
Right.
And that meant that I moved for the last sort of, quarter of my fourth year in junior school to a place called Parklands. And that was actually where my older brothers went, or I think at least one of them, and they went to Willsthorpe as well. So it was, I always wanted to go there. My younger sister went to a different school on the other side of town. She stayed there even though we moved. So we went to different schools, but lots of good memories. But from my schooling, I really just wasn't a very good student. I didn't get involved in I didn't actually like studying anything apart from, like, I used to like English literature in high school. And I also used to like metalwork and all of those sort of things. But I was terrible at math. Even now, I can remember sort of math-related stuff that is related to either photography or computers. But I'm terrible with like standard like practical math and that, and even my times table. I remember in high school, junior school, I guess as well, the teachers would say, like, you know, they'd stand you up and you'd have to like just reel off a few times table things, and I just never remembered it. I remember like six, I just, you know, you've got this, you know, 2 times 2 is 4, 4 times 4 is 8, and all of it. And I'm even saying that, look, 2 times 4 is not 8. But yeah. but like you know, I've got these things in my hang on, did I say 2? 4 times 4.
Yeah, you did say 2, unfortunately.
so what I'm saying, you know, it's like this whole thing is just like a mess in my head, and I never remembered it. And so,
which is quite amazing, because you're mainly self-taught in photography, is that correct?
It is. Yeah, I'm self-taught, but what I did basically, I mean, even when I'm calculating, like, you know, EV and aperture values and things like that, I double and half everything. I rarely times anything. It's like, so, you know, I'll get to one, an answer mathematically, I'll get to it pretty much always by either adding a zero to get 10 times, you know, that, I mean, my 10 times table is really, really good, because just add a zero on everything. But that is it. You know, so if I have to do 8, what I'll do is I'll find out what 2 of something is, and then I'll remove that 2 from a 10, which is basically something that I've added a zero on. I know that this is really confusing, but my mathematical skills are just zero, and I've got my practical math is basically all, it's like if you could create a word like Baylolian or something, that would be what it is. You know,
Well, I mean, they do say that mathematics is the universal language, and that's probably why we have all this trouble in the world.
Yeah. It's, I mean, really, I just go blank when, as soon as you start talking math, I go blank. But I was going to say, though, you know, I mean, I didn't enjoy any of the subjects at school, really, except for the things where you're either making stuff. The exception would be English. I did like English language and literature. But the other things were really like art and music, and, you know, basically things where you made things. But I was not. The thing that changed me when it came to studying was coming to Japan, because I remember, you know, coming over here and you'd only got to learn a little bit of word, you know, a few words, and the Japanese are so kind. They'll say, "Oh, your Japanese is amazing," and you know, and right. I've learned like 3 words. but that was a big thing for me. It was, you know, I respond well to praise, you know. So as soon as I got a little bit of praise, I'm thinking, maybe I can learn this. Yeah, you know, so I mean, one of the reasons I came to Japan was to learn Japanese, but I got those little bits of praise, and that really, really forced me on, and so I started to understand the value of study after coming to Japan when I was 24.
Right. Well, that's a big jump from primary school. So.
It is. Well, my whole schooling in England was basically just I don't know, it was a waste of time, to be honest.
Well, should we move on to the Japan side of the interview, or would you like to recall some more about the family and the childhood stories that you may have?
Let's talk through that first. I'm as you can tell, I'm not a very good interviewer. I jump around a lot. But yeah, family circumstances. I've just to sort of give a bit of background. When I was born, my dad was a lorry driver, truck driver. And he became a bus driver when I was small. His name was Tom. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago. I think it was 12 years ago now. And my mum's still sort of alive and kicking. And her name's Janet. She lives in Sheffield now, near my sister, who moved there. My oldest brother's Sean. I don't exactly know what to call him. Is he a detective or an inspector or something? In the police force. He was in the army for 20 years as I grew up. He left home when I was pretty small, but I really got to know him and got him and made another friend in my late teens when he started to come back to England a little bit more. And then, of course, I came to Japan and left him over there.
Right.
I've got another.
Just as you made friends again.
Yeah. We're still very good friends. He's visited us here in Japan a few times. But you know, we're on the other side of the world now. But yeah, he's an inspector or detective or whatever you want to call him. And then I've got another brother below him called Phil, who is basically the other side. He's been in and out of prison more times than we could count. I think by the time he was 24, about 24, he'd spent a third of his life in prison and borstals and things. So, with him, it was basically drug related. He was either selling drugs, getting arrested for sort of drug related things, or he was being arrested for burglary to sell them to get the money to buy drugs. And he was a bit of a black sheep in the family. I don't know if it's politically correct to say that.
Well, I was just going to ask you that because a lot of people would just sort of like introduce their middle brother as maybe Phil, who really doesn't do a lot.
Well, you know, actually, it was strange because we my mum sent me a clipping from a newspaper maybe a year or so after I was in after I came to Japan, and I was there. Basically, she was really proud because Sean, my oldest brother, was getting a medal. It was something in the newspaper clipping. It said like Willsthorpe boy. I mean, you know, the school that I went to. Willsthorpe boy gets medal for something or other. I forget what it was for. And it showed you my brother there, all proud, getting a medal pinned onto his shoulder by some sergeant major or something in the army.
And high-ranking military officer.
Yeah. And so I'm there. I'm thinking, oh wow, that's really cool. And I don't know if my mum knew this or not, but I turned it over. And
oh no!
From the same clipping in the same paper, literally on the other side, it was Philip David Bailey failed to appear in Ilkeston Magistrates Courts today on charges of assaulting an officer on Valentine's Day. Apparently, my other brother had been fighting with a police officer on Valentine's Day and hadn't turned up in court for it.
And it was and I was in the same
right.
bit of paper.
What a coincidence! Oh. I mean, two brothers being in the same newspaper is pretty rare anyway, and they actually put it on the opposite side of the same page. So that was pretty wacky.
So hopefully your mum didn't notice, or maybe she just would have failed to see it regardless.
Yeah. I need to ask her. I'll ask her next time I talk with her just to see if she knew about that.
So was photography part of your life at this stage, or was it far too early? Was there anybody around you that was taking photos? And
in our house there was very little photography. In fact, My dad bought a Polaroid camera. I think it was around the time when my sister was born. And I have one photo of me when I was 19 months, literally as my sister, at the same time my sister was born. I'll send you the photo and let you take a look at that. But I scanned this photo into using a scanner, one of the early scanners. I think it was 95 or 96. When I was at college here in Japan. And basically this Polaroid had been used as a coaster. So there was, you can't really see in the scanning, and it's a pretty low quality scan as well. But you can see where the photograph has stuck to the cup as it's been taken off, and then it's been folded and it's a mess, you know, it's just ripped and creased. So I scanned it in, and then I had to sort of clone one ear and mirror image thing and put that onto the other ear on the other side because there was no ear.
All right.
And then I did some really bad cloning. It was with Photoshop. I think it was probably 3 or 4 or something. One of the
real. So this is you saving one of the only existing photographs of yourself right. as a baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
As a toddler. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I mean, after that, I've got one other photograph, which I think I know that it was taken in November when I was 5, so it would be 72. I was born 67, so in 1972 in November, I'd got one photograph of me, and I actually look really, really cute. It's before I started to really get into my lifelong battle against overweightedness or being overweight. But I actually look pretty cute in that photo. But that's an old black and white one of the earliest school photos. I did actually have my interest in photography, although it didn't really come to much when I was a kid, was really started more by my friend's father. I got a good friend to this day. His name's Jim Canning. And he, you know, we met actually when I was 3 years old. We turned a corner. I was on my trike and he came round on his trike. We're trundling along and we bumped into each other on the corner of the block. He lived on the other side of the block. And we, you know, from at that point, we sort of said, you know, oh, hello, my name's Martin. And, oh, my name's Jim. Even then, you know, he said to me, you know, do you want to come to my place, you know, come to our house and play? And I said, no, let's go to mine, you know, and I've had my own way ever since.
Right.
But basically, his dad was a keen photographer. You know, he'd got a really old Pentax. Not sure. But actually, the word Zenith comes to mind as well. I need to check that as well.
Zenith. But, no, that's a Russian camera.
Yeah? That comes to mind. I forget what it is. I'm not sure. It was either a Pentax or a Zenith. I think it was probably a Pentax. But it was, you know, it looks a little bit like my AE-1. I've got an old, an old Canon camera, one of the first ones to have a computer built into it. His name's also Jim. It's actually his name's Robert, but everyone called him Jim for some reason. So it was Big Jim and Little Jim. But he was really into photography, and you know, I just every so often he'd take us out in the garden, and we'd take some photos, old black and whites, and we basically would, you know, we'd go on holiday together, and he'd say, do you want to take a photo? And he'd set it up, and then he'd let me click and wind it on. And that was really my first contact with photography. And I just thought that the gear was really, really cool. And then when we got home, he'd show me the photo that I clicked. You know, he'd basically set it up, or, you know, or at least sort of told me what to do. But, you know, that was really it. And even at those early stages, I just really loved the, you know, the metal and the gear and the engineering of the camera and that, and then looking at the end results and just thinking it was pretty amazing.
And so that was your only exposure to photography. Your father having a Polaroid camera, which what happened to the Polaroid?
He figured out, you know, he's very impulsive, loves new stuff, but he was very impulsive, a little bit like me.
I was imagining that.
And so basically he bought this thing and then realized how expensive the film cartridges were. And so it disappeared. I think he just sold it on, you know, thought, okay, this is too expensive. Not going to bother with this. And just sold it on. But, you know, I think that after that, I got interested in photography again, or the next sort of contact with photography was when I was 14 and I went on holiday to Wales. And my, you know, whenever we went on holiday, my dad would sort of give us like £25 or something like that, and that would be our spending money for the holiday. But I was really, like I say, really impulsive, and I'd run out on the first day with all of this money that I'd got and buy something that I would use through the holiday. And basically, on this holiday when I was 14, I ran out and got a little, I think it's 11 millimeter. It's a 110 camera, these tiny little film things that you put in there. But it was the first camera that I owned, and I remember sort of spending time in Wales shooting the landscapes, and there's some really nice landscapes there with these promontories going out into the ocean, well, the sea. Actually, no, it will be the ocean if it was Wales. So yeah, I bought a few films, rolls of film, and started to do that. And then took a few more rolls of film over the next few years with that camera, but that was really it until my late teens, early 20s, when I started to get hold of these, like literally plastic film holders with a lens. I think it was Super Snaps in the UK. Where basically you could buy a roll of 35 millimeter film that came with a little like attachment that was literally just to house the film, and you know, stop. It was obviously a light type box, and it had a little plastic lens on the front, and you literally just exposed it, click, and then wound it on with this tiny little cog wheel thing there.
I imagine that you don't have any of those photos still left, or if you do, can you get hold of them so that we could?
I lost them all. Basically, when I came to Japan, I left someone that I was, foolishly going to get married to. I left her in my old home and my old house that I bought when I was like 19, and because things didn't go so well with us after I moved to Japan, apart from the fact that she spent sort of pretty much every penny that I earned for the first 6 months, we didn't split up on great terms. So I most of the stuff that I'd got ended up sort of being, I don't know, probably cut up and stuck pins in it or threw darts at it and stuff. So I don't have any of the images that I made in my late teens and early 20s.
But you do have your childhood photos, and I think for those people that view it on the Enhanced podcast, I think there's good reason to have a good laugh at cute Martin Bailey.
I'll stick them in there. So as we're talking about these things, the photos that we've just spoken about, I'll put a few in the feed, and I'll put a blog post up so people can take a look at the photographs that I was talking about.
Right, perfect. So then you moved to Japan. Now, what was the reason for the move to Japan, and when did that happen?
Well, this is a really weird story, but basically, I just to sort of give you a little bit of background to build up to that, I left high school in 83 into the middle of Thatcher's Britain. There were riots going off in various parts of the country, and the unemployment was incredibly high, and I basically, at the time, going to university was totally out of the question. Pretty much, I don't even think at the time I knew anyone that went to university from my high school. Although I'm sure there were, but people that I hung around with didn't. And so I never had an education. I went into, after high school at 16, I did a few small jobs, but then or jobs for a short while, but then I went into the lace industry, which is basically, and this is not race, as in, in Japan, because it's very difficult for people to, the L's and R's in Japan are basically in the Japanese alphabet. It's that.
Yes.
It's between the two.
I can just imagine it.
So, so when I say that I used to work in lace, they would say, "Oh, you're a racing driver," and I'd say, "No, not race, lace." So. I basically, the Nottingham lace or Lever's lace is a trade that in Nottingham, obviously, the name Nottingham sticks in there, Nottingham lace. It was one of the main trades in that area. And it was a big thing from the Industrial Revolution onwards, Nottingham lace. And so basically I got into that. I ended up doing that for a number of years, about 8 years or so, after I left high school. And one morning I was in the canteen in the lace factory, and the canteen lady sort of pointed out this advertisement in the local newspaper for, it basically said in big black letters, "Working in Japan." And at the time, I'd never had this much of an education. I didn't like school, didn't going to university wasn't even a thought in the corner of my mind. Nothing was going to get me into university at that time anyway. But I did want to use my brain. I'd started at the time thinking about learning German, and I was looking into going to some evening classes and things like that to learn German. And then all of a sudden this possibility of going to Japan came up. Basically, it was making lace here in Japan.
Japanese decided to compete with Nottingham lace.
Yeah, right. Okay. So basically what I did was I thought, okay, well, this looks interesting, and Japanese, although obviously there's, learning German would have been a good thing. It's another European language, but Japanese, being able to learn Japanese was like, it was so much more, I don't know, cool or whatever, but you know, I knew nobody that could speak Japanese, and it just seemed so far. It's, you know, we even call it the Far East, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm thinking, okay, so Japanese is a cool language. I could probably go over there, and I just thought, why not? So I'll give them a call. I was working shifts at the time. I was working from 6 till 2, and then 2 till 10 at night, and I was on the morning shift. So I left the factory, at 2 o'clock. Went for the interview, got the job, went back home, wrote my notice letter, which was a week because we were paid weekly at that time. Went back to the office and gave the foreman my notice on the Monday afternoon. And I landed in Tokyo. I jumped on the plane on the Saturday and I landed in Tokyo, I think it was the Sunday. So it was less than a week from when I decided to come that I actually arrived here. So, you know, this impulsive.
Very impulsive. I guess you're standing there in Japan and going, well, I wonder if that was a good decision at the time.
Well, you know, the thing is, the first few days, I was in a hotel room. They stuck us in this hotel. It was single rooms with two beds in, like an L shape. So my feet were at the head of another guy's bed. And there were four of us over there initially. And you know, for the first few days, I was a little bit homesick, and I was thinking, is this the right thing to have done? But I got up on, I think it was the third morning, and I went out onto the roof. It was the fourth floor of a hotel in a small town in northern Japan, and I went out onto the roof and looked across. It was a clear, beautiful, clear March morning, and I looked across at the mountains, and yeah, they were still snow covered in, you know, from the winter snow, and I just thought, I want to live here, I want to stay here, and it was, you know, from the third day, I just felt that I wanted to spend the rest of my life here, and right. So, you know, I mean, it didn't happen quite as easily as that. I was here for 6 years initially. The lace work lasted for about 3 years, and then they decided, well, I mean, excuse me, part of the reason why they even had us go over there from England was because they had started to build a factory in China, because, you know, the labor costs were less, they could make the lace for less money. So they decided that they were going to do the the China thing, and so as they built that factory up, they let us go. And again, coming back to the fact that I'd got no education, no higher education, I didn't want to go back to England, so I decided to go to college over here, and that's what I did. I moved to a city called Sendai, and I went to college. I was in the first multimedia course in a college called Tohoku Denshi Keisanki Senmon Gakko, which is basically like that's right. It was JC21 was the thing on the building. If anyone listening is in Sendai, it's a small building very close to the station in Sendai. Did I just say small building? It's yes. Small. It's small compared to, I think it was like 12 stories or maybe a little bit more, but it's small compared to some of the new buildings around it. It's a pretty big building, so I don't quite know what I'm talking about now. But it's, you know, I went there for, yeah, sorry, Jack.
So Japan for you, I mean, just getting back to that time when you went up on the rooftop and you had a look around and you saw the mountains, and it was obviously a clear day. I mean, did that seem like a new, fresh start for you, far, far away from everything else? And that's what was so interesting about it.
I think it did, and by this time, I'd bought a few. I came over with an Olympus trip. I knew that I was going to start to get into photography as well as learning the language, and I'd come over with an Olympus trip, and I'd started to photograph Japan, and it was just, it all seemed, like you say, so fresh, and it was, you know, it was just a whole new world, and
yeah.
And of course, the people were just amazing. There was the Japanese people in the factory and in the hotel and everything. They were all so kind, and like I said earlier, you know, even if you just learned a couple of words, how to say hello or good morning and things like that, if you said those, they made a big fuss of you for trying. And so it was just totally new, and the culture was just so different from England that it really just opened my eyes to a whole new world.
Yeah, fantastic. And getting back to the lace side of things, so I guess you're very experienced in items that might be sold at, I don't know,
in
places like Victoria's Secrets, maybe?
Well, we never really saw what happened to them. Literally, these machines they're like maybe 30 feet long, and they make like a 20 foot wide piece of lace. Actually, it's split into two, so two 10 foot wide pieces of lace. And they, you know, it comes off the machines in large strips, you know, that are maybe 100 foot long, maybe longer. And they will, they're basically, what happens then is there's these little parts of it that you cut away, and then it falls off into strips that are either like, you know, the very sort of ornate lace that goes on underwear and things, and or to even wider strips that make up larger parts of blouses and things. But it's not sitting there with a cushion like weaving. You know, it's actually quite a strenuous job. It's a skill. I mean, it's a skilled trade. It was in Nottingham and Long Eaton, where most of it was made. It was a skilled trade, and it was a very respectable trade for a long time. But you know, I mean, I even remember going into the factory, and one of the first memories that I've got in there was there was a guy called Koga-chan, and he spoke like a caveman. He was really, really difficult to understand his Japanese, but he jumped up. He stopped his machine and jumped up onto it and pointed, really excited, at the top where it said Nottingham 1898 or something like that. And literally in the wrought iron frame of the lace machines was the old, you know, where they were made and the year they were made. And so what they'd done is basically they'd shipped these huge machines over to Japan from Nottingham, you know, and they were the same machines that I'd been using before I left. So right. It was really, really weird. Very strange.
No, it's... And what about Japan? I take it that Japan is now an adopted country for you. Are you looking for permanent residency there? And do you think it's going to be permanent for you from now on?
Yeah, well, I kind of sidetracked myself earlier. I was here 6 years initially, and I did go back to England in 97 until 2000. So I spent just over 3 years back there at the end of the last millennium. And all the time I was there, though, I was gearing up to come back. You know, my main goal for the whole time I was there was getting back to Japan. So, you know, I got myself an MCSE, the Microsoft Certified Systems Engineer thing. Worked really hard to sort of self-study and build on my IT background that I'd got. I was lucky enough to get into a really good job because I got the Japanese skills as well, but I really just wanted to come back to Japan. So, you know, the company that I started working for in the last sort of year that I was there, I was working as a contractor and was about to quit because it was a long way from where I lived in Nottingham. And they said, what if there's a chance of going back to Japan with us? So, you know, the company that I still do my main day job now, actually moved me back to Japan, and that was just over nine years ago now.
Okay.
So, but yeah, I mean that this is it. I don't intend to go back to England. As much as I love England as my sort of my motherland, or you know, my home country, I just love Japan more, and you know, just everything about the place. I think photographically, I prefer it to England. You know, we've got Hokkaido and Nagano and all of these beautiful places that I head out to whenever I can. But also, even in Tokyo, there's, you know, there's so much to do, and it's just, to me, I mean, I'll tell you what, the biggest moment of realization for me, although I said earlier, you know, that I decided on the third day that I wanted to stay here, I really realized how much I love being in Japan when I got back here after my first holiday. And I'd been over to England in the September of 91. And I got back here and stood on the train platform in Tokyo waiting to get onto the bullet train to come back up to the northern Japan where I was living. And I just felt that I was like, I breathed a huge sigh of relief. I felt alienated when I was back in England, and coming back to Japan, I just felt so at home. And so I realized then that this really is it for me. And so, even though I made the best of the 3 years that I was back there, I was also able, by coincidence, I was around for my dad when he died. He died the year I went back to England.
Right.
So I was also able to do up the house that I left there and sell that. So it was good, and also my wife got to go over to England with us as well for the 3 years, so that was a good experience for her. But then we came back to Japan, became reaccustomed to being here, and it just we both agree that it's the best place for us to be. She didn't want to come back to England to Japan actually at first, because she really didn't enjoy living over in England. But it was just one of those things that, realistically, we had to come back, and I wanted to. And having come back and settled in, she thinks that it's the best thing to do as well. So we're happy enough. And like you say, the question: do you plan on staying here permanently? Absolutely.
Right, and the house. I mean, you're living in Tokyo, so I imagine that the apartment that you've mentioned on the podcast previously is relatively small in comparison to maybe the places that you might have stayed in Nottingham, but or around that region.
Yeah.
Is that the case?
Yeah. The words rabbit and hutch come to mind.
Right.
And without wanting to upset any animal lovers, obviously I'm an animal lover myself, but you couldn't swing a cat here.
Yeah.
At least not one with a tail longer than 3 centimeters. But I literally, I'm doing this recording now. My computer space is, I think it's about 1.5 square meters in the corner of the room. I build vertically, so I've got a desk that is basically maybe 90 centimeters by 90 centimeters, and it's got a platform on the top with my printer. I'm like the skyscrapers here. Everything goes vertical and not horizontal. But we live in a relatively large apartment by Japanese standards, because we've got a separate living room and bedroom, and we've got a dining kitchen, but then that's it. It's 3 rooms. We've got the bathroom and toilet, but that's it. My bookshelf is actually built in the hallway. If the washing machine broke, we couldn't get a new one in, because the bookshelf takes up half of the hallway width.
Right.
But literally, it's small. I am planning on moving at some point, probably early next year. But there's been a few things that really have to get into place before that happens. But the plan is to move, and when I do, I'll move out of the city into the suburbs a little bit. Maybe pay about the same, hopefully a little bit less. But then I want a photography room that I can use for, both all of the gear, but also as a bit of a studio. But that's coming up in hopefully early 2010.
Yeah, okay. Because I know that I get in trouble all the time for leaving my gear out and about. And in Australia, houses certainly go horizontally rather than vertically in the suburbs. So we have got a lot of space, but I could certainly imagine the tight squeeze that you're talking about there. It's amazing, just thoughts on that. And what about commuting and other such matters? How are you accepted now? You've been there. You obviously speak Japanese maybe as fluently as a Westerner could. Mm. Do you hang around with expats or Japanese or a mixture? Or
I actually am pretty antisocial. I don't have many. I've got a few people that I would call friends, but they're very few, and I've never chose a friend because of the nationality or I hate it when people try to befriend me just because I'm a foreigner. I you usually find me either just walking away from conversations that turn into that, or I just don't follow up on with, you know, people try to be. I just don't like the fact. Although obviously, I mean, I've never been more aware than I'm a foreigner. You know, holding up the two fingers as a quote thing here. I'm aware of it every day. You know, I can't walk out into the streets without knowing that people are aware that I'm not, you know, native to this land. But I really don't like people that differentiate or discriminate is maybe not the best word. But Japan, you know, the Japanese people are great, but they're very aware of their own nationality. And in a good way, in some ways, you know, they don't mind. I mean, in England, you don't talk about race or nationality. You know, no matter what the color of someone's skin is, or you know, where they're from, you just don't talk about it. But in Japan, it's one of the first things people say is, "Where are you from?" You know. So yeah. I mean, and even if I was born here, I would spend my whole life, explaining to people where I'm from or why I'm. Look like this and stuff like that. So I'm always aware that I'm a foreigner in this land. But I don't like it when people, like I say, try to befriend me or, you know, obviously there are benefits to being a foreigner here, but I really don't like it when people sort of, again, I'm going to say discriminate, not in a really bad way, but just, you know, people make a point of it. I'm not too interested in that. And like I say, I mean, your question was, do I have a mixture of friends? Yes, I do, but it's based on them as human beings rather than their nationalities.
Sure. Yeah. It speaks a lot for your ability to fit in that particular case. And obviously you've been there for a long time. I'd imagine speaking is one thing, but your ability to read and write Japanese is sort of takes it to a whole new level.
That it makes it so much easier. I mean, as I said earlier, one of the reasons that I came to Japan was because I wanted to learn the language. And I spent the first year just learning how to converse. But then on the second and third year, I decided that I wanted to learn to read and write. And so I'd literally spent, maybe four hours or so every day for the second and third year just writing out characters and learning how to read and write. There's 2,000 characters in everyday use here, and basically what I did was I just wrote them all out all the time. Once I got past 200, I split them up. But I would, you know, but towards the end when I knew like 1,600, 1,800 or so, I'd write out the first 200 one day, the second 200 the next day, the third 200 the next day, and so on. And basically just wrote them. And, you know, obviously at the same time, what I was doing was I was looking at the English meaning or the Japanese phonetic reading of the character and then forcing myself to recall how it's written in the ideograms, the kanji, and then wrote those out. And then at the end of having written out my 200 characters for that day, I would learn 10 more new ones. And then what I did was the book that I used to learn them with, excuse me, was it had five characters on one page and five on the next. And I would, learn at least five. But then if I could recall those and, you know, think that they were going to be relatively easy to remember, I'd learn five more on one day. But literally doing it that way. And then those would be the first characters that I would try to write down the following day. And then I'd write out my 200 characters and then learn some more. But that took me 2 years to cram basically what the Japanese take like their 12 years of schooling to do. I crammed that in 2 years. And at the time, I mean, by the time I'd finished learning those kanji characters, I was able to hand write them out better than most Japanese people because, you know, you don't write that much. But now, you know, after a few years, I mean, I got into computers at the time and you use a... what they call an input method editor to write. Obviously, you can't have a keyboard with 2,000 characters, and there's actually 50,000 characters that you can write in Japanese. So you have to use computers to do that. But people depend on computers so much now that even the Japanese people don't handwrite them as, you know, recall them and write them as well as they used to do. But to me, being able to at least read and then handwrite when, you know, when necessary is, it's a huge plus. I mean, I don't feel as though I'm, you know, handicapped in any way living here.
Oh, that's fantastic. And what about photography as far as the levels that we're talking about being that you're at now? You know, when did that start? I mean, that obviously happened during the time that you were in Japan.
Right. Yeah. So what happened there was I bought a camera when I first came, but sent that back to England within weeks because I realized that the cameras you could buy here were so much more advanced. And I, from the very start, just the fact that everything was so different, naturally, the first thing that that really started to catch my eye over here was the temples and shrines and the culture. So festivals and things like that. I was really photographing those a lot when I first got here. But my interest in photography originally in my late teens, early 20s, when I was back in England, started when I was hiking in the Pennines in England, shooting the beautiful mountains in Derbyshire and the Lake District as well. And so I quickly decided that I needed to get out of the town and go into the natural places. And so I with my first camera that I bought over here, I started to get into the mountains and shooting the landscapes around in the Fukushima area, which is where I was living. And then the woman that I left back in England on the only holiday that I spent with her when I went back in that September, she broke the camera that I had.
So, was that at the end of the relationship at that point?
Yes. Well, apart from the fact that she'd spent all of the money that I sent back for the first 6 months, she actually broke my camera. So that was the end of the last straw. So we broke up shortly after that. I decided that I wanted an SLR. I bought myself an SLR that I used for the next, I think it would probably be 10 years or so. And I brought it back to England with me in 97 and then came back to Japan with it in 2000. But just before I came back to Japan, I'd bought my first digital camera, but it was a compact digital, 2 megapixel. I think it was a Canon PowerShot S10, which is, it was a 2 megapixel compact camera. Not great, but it was just so much better than the film. You know, just although I've got a lot of nostalgic feelings towards film, I was just amazed at the fact that we could shoot these images. Obviously, I mean, I'd been aware of digital photography because when I was in college in 95, 96, 97, we'd had digital photography there, and I'd been using Photoshop. I've actually got, I've passed exams as a Photoshop user while I was at college. All of those exams, actually, they were all in Japanese as well. So that was another thing that I was able to do. I graduated from college. All of it was in Japanese, and I graduated top of the class. So I was pretty pleased about that. But I'm digressing again. I decided, that digital was the way to go. Although I'd got this compact camera now, I had a bit of a dry period. I've got to say, although I did a lot of photography in the first 4 years or so that I was here, once I went back to college and started to try and improve my education, I didn't have the money to. I was literally having to work in a bar and pay my tuition and rent and everything just on a part-time job. So I didn't have the money to develop film and things. So I had a very dry period from 95 until 2000 or so when I came back. I didn't even expose many rolls of film while I was back in England because I was too busy just trying to keep my head above water.
I think that's an amazing fact about digital, is because it certainly has enabled a lot of people, especially younger people, to get into serious photography without having to put up the money that previously was required. Because I've heard similar stories from other photographers where
right.
the film aspect of it and the cost of that, unless you were working professionally and were supplied with film for free and at least had the ability to develop the negatives for free,
right.
then you're certainly constrained as to how much money you could dedicate towards photography.
Absolutely. I basically what happened with me, I mean, I think that what you've just said is 100% true today, and has been for the last few years. My main problem was that I spent, must have been, I don't know, probably about $4,000. It was 380,000 yen for the D30, not the 30D, but the D30, which was one of the original Canon digital SLRs. And I bought that in 2001, I think it was. And unfortunately, I bought it about 2 weeks before they released the D60. I'd not studied, again, impulsive Martin, ran out and bought this. When I realized that they'd got digital SLRs, I thought, okay, this is something that I need to get. I need to get into this. So I literally paid a fortune for my original D30. Now it is so much cheaper. I mean, if you want a digital SLR, you can get them for under $1,000 now. Yes. And although that's still a lot more expensive than your base, you know, start of the range filmed SLRs, it's just so much cheaper now that the barrier is much, much lower.
And that's obviously the same time that Canon used to kick off the camera names with the D in front of it as opposed to behind the number.
Right, yeah. So it was the D30, the D60 came out, and miraculously, I mean, I was able to... It was double the pixels. It was my D30 was three megapixels, and the D60 was 6 megapixels, which I would have loved. But I managed to not buy the D60, and the next upgrade was to the 10D. And of course with the 10D the price came down considerably, and then just continued to do so.
Yeah, and you chose Canon.
I'd basically the first 35 millimeter camera that I bought when I got here was I think it was called a Auto Boy, PowerShot Auto Boy, and it was literally, you know, you've got to love the naming. But it was literally it looked like a telescope. It was a long camera. You held it, not quite the same as a normal 35 millimeter camera. And when you turned it on, the front opened out, and that became the flash. It was pretty revolutionary camera, but I just wanted I wanted more control, and that was why I went to an SLR. But then, you know, once I moved to SLR, I just naturally went with Canon because that was what I'd bought my first sort of reasonable point and shoot 35 millimeter camera. I didn't have any, I mean, at the time, I think I looked at Nikon and Pentax because they were also making great cameras, of course. But I just, I don't know, to me, it just felt natural to go for Canon.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about the timings of it, but when you talk about the cost of entry into the body of, I think that the first time I saw that a digital SLR from Nikon was released below the $2,000 mark was the D70.
Mm, yeah. Because, I mean, you're a Nikon guy, right? Or yes, not a Nikon guy.
Yeah, it depends how you want to say it. That's right, yeah. So I shoot with the D700.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great camera. I mean, I really don't subscribe to the sort of the Mac Windows or the Canon Nikon sort of debates. They both make excellent cameras. I don't think that there are many other companies that are even in the running. Although you know, Sony a number of other companies are making great cameras. The two companies that are really heading up the charge is Nikon and Canon. But you know, I mean, one year one of them's going to be pushing the envelope and coming out with some really revolutionary stuff. I think that the 7D is one of the a good example of that, as well as the 100 millimeter macro with the hybrid IS that I just bought. These things are changing. These are slightly revolutionary again. The 7D's got amazing autofocus, but you know, and it could be argued that, you know, that the Canon range isn't really close to Nikon on the autofocus anyway. You know, people have mentioned that, you know, they've had that sort of autofocus for years. But I think that the 7D is taking it a step further, even than the better autofocus that Nikon has. But, you know, 1 year Canon will be ahead. And then, like last year with the low noise, high ISO, Nikon was obviously leading. And so it doesn't really matter which you buy into, because they're going to both continue to push the envelope and push the technology forward.
Look, I totally agree. I think the fanboys are there purely to rile the companies into competing so that we all benefit.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the, you know, as obviously, and this is nothing new, but most people understand that the major investment is in the glass. So, you know, once you've bought into a system and you have, you know, maybe $10,000, $20,000 worth of lenses. Yeah, especially, I mean, it depends what you're doing, of course, but...
Yeah, or unless you're Scott Bourne.
Yeah, and of course, yeah. I mean, Scott can afford to jump ship. But I, you know, I don't do badly, of course, and, you know, I do sort of channel back all of the money that I make from photography into photography, but I generally wouldn't consider jumping ship just because of a camera body, because I know that even if Nikon had something that I really wanted now, Canon will have it and probably more in a year's time, and then of course Nikon will have something better in a year following that. But really, I mean, for me, with me being a nature and wildlife predominantly shooter, I basically have a hell of a lot of lenses in the, you know, the long range. I mean, like, it's the 600 millimeters, a $10,000 lens. You don't just sort of switch systems when you've got that kind of investment in the glass.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think we're sort of moving towards the gear a little bit too much in this answer, but that's always the case, isn't it, when you start talking about equipment. Yeah. But I do actually have some questions for you towards later stages about equipment.
Okay.
Probably more so as to where it's heading as opposed to where it is.
Mm.
But getting back to that start in photography, when you really felt that your level of photography was close to where it is now, or certainly in this phase, that obviously happened after the purchase of the digital SLR cameras.
Yeah.
I guess you had to replace added to the lenses at that point.
So this is a bit of a running joke with me and my wife. Initially, I talked her into letting me spend this like $4,000 on the D30 because I'd already got all of the lenses. You know, all I needed was the body, and I was set. But even with the three, you know, relatively small 3 megapixels that the D30 had, I instantly saw that the three lenses, two of the three lenses that I originally owned were crap. I had a 24 millimeter f/2.8, which was actually very sharp, and I loved that lens. But the other lenses that I had, I think it was a 35mm to 105 or 135 zoom, and the other one was a 100 to 300. And as soon as I started to be able to look at these things at 100% on the screen, I realized that they were soft as hell. And so in the first year, I mean, the first lens that I bought, because I'd gone, you know, I was on a 1.6 times crop factor camera, was the 17 to 35 millimeter L lens, the f/2.8. That was, you know, followed. That was replaced by the 16 to 35, and then the 16 to 35 Mark II. But you know, the first thing that I did after I realized that my original lenses were crap was went out and bought an L lens. So, you know, so Canon were there, you know, as they have done ever since, you know, laughing their way to the bank. But
yes,
know, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the industrial, the digital revolution just slipped 100 years or so there. The digital revolution has basically given people the ability to see how crap their old glass was. Having said that, even now, you don't need L lenses to get the best quality, because even the lower range, probably... But the kit lenses that you get now are better than the lenses that we had 20 years ago. But people definitely can see the shortcomings in their gear, in their glass, a lot more easily now, because you've got the cameras that are, you know, over 10 megapixels, over 20 megapixels in some cases. And these are unforgiving. You know, the resolution is so great now that they will show you if your lens is soft. And people are prepared now to buy professional lenses, where, I mean, that never happened before. In the film days, only professionals bought professional lenses. But now, you know, anyone that's got a little bit of disposable income and enough interest in the hobby or trade, obviously if it's your job, it's a different matter. But people are generally more willing now to buy top quality glass. And it's gratifying as well. When you see the sharpness of the images that you can make now, it's, you know, it's hard to sort of to resist in some cases as well.
Well, certainly when you're talking about the typical effort that you'd have to go to take some of those shots in nature, if you are going to invest that much time and effort, you would want to be using high level equipment to capture that shot, because, you know, a lot of work goes into maybe one or two photos that are then viewed by others.
Right.
You know, in cases there'll be weeks of planning and effort to get to that one keeper or two keepers that you end up displaying.
Right. Right. And even that, I mean, obviously we shouldn't put too much emphasis on the gear, because I actually in the workshops, you know, there are a few people that I have become good friends with that have joined us on the workshops, and yet when we compare images, you know, we're using either the same lenses or similar lenses, and you know, a lot of the time my images are sharper, and so what's happening there obviously is that I don't want to sort of blow my own trumpet here, but it's, you know, technique is a huge thing, and although I try to teach this on the workshops, still, you know, some people just don't come away with quite so sharp images, and so, you know, the focusing techniques and longer lenses, you know, you have to support them, you have to put your hand over them and push down on the lens to make sure that they don't vibrate when you use these big long lenses, and so there's a lot of technique that helps you to get the really, really sharp shots, but I pride myself on being able to zoom in to an image at 100%. Sure, it's pixel peeping, but if it's not sharp, you know, if it's not sharp, it's not sharp. I have thrown out some amazingly good photographs because they're soft, and some people will say, well, I'd use that, and I basically am thinking, I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't put this thing up for sale and allow people to buy it if they're going to come back to me and say, well, this is soft. I'll say, yeah, it is, I'm sorry about that, you know. I don't want to put myself in that position. I'd rather not use the image than, I mean, obviously, and I'm saying this because some are soft, technique will get you there a lot of the time, but every so often, you know, you just can't quite cut it. But it's every so often, you know, that you get the soft ones, and I will throw them out. I'll either delete them. I mean, if it's just a tad soft, then, you know, I can't pretend that I'm totally ruthless with this, because if it's just a tad soft and a little bit of like, you know, sharpening around the eyes will rescue it, then that's something I will consider. But
right,
if it's just, you know, if it's obviously soft, I'll maybe not delete it, because you don't know what technology is going to help you to do in a few years' time. But I will, you know, if it's really soft, I'll just delete it and get it off the hard drive.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm not surprised that you say that, because it certainly comes across like that in previous podcasts. Yeah. Whenever you talk about images in relation to sharpness,
yeah.
Definitely.
Okay, so I'm going to cut it off there. This is me out of the interview. Just finished editing the first part. I didn't actually cut anything out. I just trip the end off and stuff. But because this is a 2-hour and 20-minute interview, I'm going to cut it into two halves, and we'll hear the second half next week. I would like to quickly mention the October assignment theme before we finish today, and the theme is only 50mm. We usually shy away from anything that requires a certain piece of equipment, but it's probably safe to say that everyone has either a 50mm prime or a zoom lens that passes through the 50mm focal length. To really benefit yourself from this assignment, if you don't have a 50mm prime lens, you'll want to tape your 50mm lens. You know, use some tape that doesn't leave residue or sticky stuff on the lens. If you shoot film, of course, this is not possible, but you know, if you are a digital shooter, then please make sure that the EXIF data remains intact so that you can check, you know, so that I can check that the image was shot at 50mm. And if you tape the lens, it seems right, you know, you think you're at 50mm, but the EXIF is off, we'll accept images that are 5mm either way, so a 45 to 55mm EXIF data, you know, reading will be fine. But the goal should be to shoot at 50mm. Also remember that, you know, the general idea is just to sort of, you know, to limit yourself. So, you know, we're not too worried about it being exactly spot on. It's more the exercise. The Lens Baby lenses without an adapter or filter of any kind are 50mm, so they're acceptable for this assignment. And the subject can be anything that you like. You know, so you really just sort of knock yourself out with this one. Note that even if you have a crop factor camera like a 1.6, 1.5 or 1.3 crop factor, you still need to use a 50mm focal length. There's no need to factor in the crop factor, you know, so what it says on the barrel of the lens is where you want to be. And that of course will be what is registered in the EXIF data as well. Also for this assignment, let's outlaw cropping in post, apart from when you do slight image rotation if necessary. But if possible, take that into account too, so that you can post an uncropped image. And of course, we'll be working on an honor system here, because we can't tell once you've resized if it was cropped or not. All images must be posted by the end of the last day of October. Indeed, they must be shot during October 2009. And after that, after the last day of October, I will lock the assignment album at mbpgalleries.com and turn on the voting system for 2 weeks. For details of the rules of the assignment and the voting system, etc., take a look at the assignment forum at martinbaileyphotography.com. Apart from that, though, thanks for listening today, and I really hope that you enjoyed this first part of the interview. And we get into a load of other stuff in the second part, so look forward to that. Okay, so that's it. I'll speak to you again next week when we'll be back with another episode of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Until then, you just have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.
'Martin Bailey Photography Podcast' is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.